go back up. But I think in terms of mental health and all that, if you have this little bit of a break, it'll make people be able to last a little bit longer. Just the amount of time that they then can go back into lockdown restrictions, because otherwise people are just going to be fed up at the end of the day. I know people are already fed up.
I don't think I will, because it's not like the virus is going to go away for those 5 days or anything like that. So no, I don't think I will be mixing with people and households or anything like that.
The UK will ease out of the lockdown starting December 2nd. A new strengthened three-tier system will replace it, and mass testing in all Tier 3 areas will be rolled out. Meanwhile, the government has secured 100 million doses of a COVID-19 vaccine developed by AstraZeneca with Oxford University.
Subject to that regulatory approval, and I really stress that, because the medicines regulator, it's called the MHRA, is independent, they're rigorous, they're one of the best regulators in the world, and they will be very, very careful to ensure that they look at all the data to make sure that this is safe. Subject to that approval, we hope to be able to start vaccinating next month.
The vaccine is believed to be 90% effective when it comes to reducing transmission. The UK government has also secured tens of millions of doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines that are said to prevent getting infected in the first place. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Moving on, dozens of exhausted refugees rescued from drowning in the Atlantic Ocean have arrived at the port of Spain's Gran Canaria island. Three of them needed medical attention and were carried on stretchers and wheelchairs when the rescue boat docked. Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha González said his country would be increasing its police presence in West African nations to tackle criminal networks behind an upsurge in illegal immigration to the islands. Nearly 17,000 refugees have made the journey to the Canary Islands this year, 10 times last year's total. In a move that could further escalate tensions in the region, Turkey says it's extending seismic survey work carried out by its Uruç-Reis ship in the disputed waters of the eastern Mediterranean until November 29. The ship had been expected to finish its survey work by November 23rd, but a Turkish naval notice said the vessel would continue work in an area west of Cyprus for another 6 days. The dispute originally escalated in August when Turkey first sent the exploration ship Uruç-Reis into waters also claimed by Greece and Cyprus. More stories trending on social media. In the U.S., militia members, including members of the so-called Boogaloo movement, holding an armed march throughout Richmond, Virginia. And Richard Sedan has been following that story for us and joins me now with all the details. Richard?
Pretty incredible first story, Syed. So the white supremacist extremist group, the Boogaloo Boys, held an armed march in Richmond in the state of Virginia, basically breaking state laws. This group is literally strapped, they're armed, they're carrying munitions, literally walking past the signs that prohibit them to do so. And of course, this really poses a bit of a serious question, because if the Boogaloo Boys, who actually plotted to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, are allowed to carry guns and break the law, then what is the difference between white supremacism as an ideology and the so-called laws of the land in the United States? It's just a question I am posing. And just a reminder that there's actually situations where black people who are unarmed are literally being gunned down. And you've got a situation here where open supremacists are allowed to parade around with guns, clearly intent on causing havoc and mayhem. I want to go to a couple of reactions online first of all, if I can, Saeed, before we get into this.
Go ahead.
Filmmaker Tariq Nasheed said, deputized white supremacist group, the Boogaloo Boys, were allowed to defy gun laws today. And we have another tweet here from Strain Asylum who says, the troublemakers are not in Black Lives Matter. They are the white supremacists in the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, and similar hate groups. Black Lives Matter is not a hate group. Black Lives Matter is not trying to start a race war. It's trying to end one. And just a reminder, the Boogaloo Boys actually believe there's going to be a second civil war in the U.S. They believe such a war will be predicated along racial lines. And it seems, Saeed, like they're very much prepared for it.
They really do, don't they, Richard? Let's move on to, you spoke of Black Lives Matter. This story takes us to Brazil. Fresh anti-racism protests in that country after the death of a black man at the hands of security guards at a shopping mall. Tell us why we're highlighting this today.
Exactly. So João Alberto Silveira Freitas, a 40-year-old black Brazilian, let's just call it what it was. He was beaten to death by a couple of security guards outside a store. And as a result, there were massive protests, including in the store itself. And of course, it sparked a renewed conversation in Brazil about racism, and people have been protesting along the lines of Black Lives Matter. And it's kind of a reminder, Saeed, really, that everywhere, every corner in the world where colonialism has been exported, including to the Americas, white supremacism, racism, is as rampant now as it ever was. And I think many people are incensed about this and want justice, as you would imagine. Let's go first to Henry online, who says, black man killed by security guards is buried in Brazil, echoes those of the racial justice movement in the United States. And we have Christy James, who says, a black man was killed by two security guards. It could have been here, but it was in Brazil. A day before, they celebrate Black Consciousness Day of all days, Saeed. Something needs to change.
It certainly does, Richard. Maybe very briefly, racism has been around forever, but what we see now, thanks to technology, smartphones, we get to see what's happening to minority groups around the world. And also, we are looking at civil society reacting to acts of racism more than it used to because of what they can see on a day-to-day basis. Well, looks like we have lost Richard. He can't hear me, and we're going to have to probably leave it there. We're trying to get Richard back on and continue the conversation on that story that happened in Brazil, the death of a black man at the hands of guards outside a massive shopping mall in that country, and the fresh protests that have erupted as a result of that murder. Okay, great. We have Richard back on. And Richard, I was saying that briefly, because of smartphones, because of technology, we get to look at what is being done to black people and other communities around the world. And then as a result, we're looking at more reaction, just like in the form of those protests, whenever and wherever that happens, very briefly.
Absolutely, and it reminds me of a quote that I heard earlier on this summer. I can't remember who said it, but the quote said, racism isn't getting worse, it's just getting filmed, and that's why you're seeing more and more of these instances come to our screens, because citizen journalists, people are basically filming these instances. It's not a new phenomenon, but certainly the camera phone is allowing renewed conversations and is allowing these racist attacks to be caught on film for the world to see.
I couldn't have put it better myself. Richard Sudan with those stories. Richard, thank you. And that's all for now, everyone. Goodbye.
Joe Biden's popular vote lead over Donald Trump has now stretched to more than 6 million as he continues to rack up the highest number of votes in American history. The Democratic challenger and now president-elect currently has 79,823,827 compared to President Trump's 73,786,905. Itself a record for a losing candidate in terms of sheer number of votes cast. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Biden's Popular Vote Lead Over Trump Stretches to More Than 6 Million. Stay with us for more. Joe Biden's popular vote lead over Donald Trump has now stretched to more than 6 million as he continues to rack up the highest number of votes in American history. The Democratic challenger and now president-elect currently has 79,823,827 compared to President Trump's 73,786,905, itself a record for a losing candidate in terms of sheer number of votes cast. Biden's win in the popular vote tally has also delivered him a convincing mandate in the all-important Electoral College, which actually decides who becomes the next occupant of the White House, after flipping states like Georgia, Arizona, and the Midwestern Rust Belt states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. However, it has not stopped Donald Trump and many of his Republican allies from seeking to undermine the result of the election by launching a series of lawsuits and technical objections and asking for recounts. None of the tactics have shown any evidence to back up Trump's false claims of widespread ballot fraud. Joe Biden, who has denounced Donald Trump's attempts to reverse the election results as totally irresponsible, was spending Saturday meeting with transition advisors as he draws up his administration. Donald Trump was scheduled to participate virtually in his last summit, the summit of the G20, the 20 biggest world economies. Senior Republicans have remained largely silent about Trump's unsubstantiated claims of election fraud or have defended his right to seek redress, but pressure was building after several voiced doubts on Friday. Two Republican sources said a press conference on Thursday, at which Donald Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani accused Democrats of engaging in a national conspiracy to manipulate vote totals whilst conceding that he had no evidence, may have been a turning point for some of Trump's former allies. The General Services Administration, run by a Trump appointee, still has not recognized Joe Biden's victory, preventing his team from gaining access to government office space and funding normally provided to an incoming administration ahead of the inauguration day on 20th of January. The president-elect spent his 78th birthday on Friday in his home state of Delaware at work on government transition, including a meeting with Congress's top two Democrats, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. In 2 months, Joe Biden will take the reins of a politically fractured nation facing the worst public health crisis in a century, high unemployment and a reckoning on racial injustice. As he wrestles with those issues, Biden will be attempting to accomplish another feat, demonstrating to Americans that age is but a number and he's up to the job. Biden will be sworn in as the oldest president in the nation's history, displacing Ronald Reagan, who left the White House in 1989 when he was 77 years and 349 days old. The age and health of both Joe Biden and Donald Trump, less than 4 years Biden's junior, loomed throughout a race that was decided by a younger and more diverse electorate. Out of the gate, Biden will be keen to demonstrate he's got the vigor to serve. It's crucial that he and his staff put himself in the position early in his presidency where he can express what he wants, with a crispness that's not always been his strength, said Ross Baker, a political scientist at Rutgers University, who has advised legislators from both parties. Ross Baker added, he has got to build up credibility with the American people that he's physically and mentally up to the job. Meanwhile, senior Republicans are pressuring Donald Trump to drop his corrosive fight to overturn the 2020 election. Trump faced growing pressure from Republicans on Sunday, 22nd of November, to drop his chaotic last-ditch fight to overturn the U.S. presidential election, as Victor Joe Biden prepared to start naming his cabinet, and a Pennsylvania judge compared Trump's legal case there to Frankenstein monster. Despite Republican leadership in Washington standing behind the president's claims that the 3rd of November election was stolen from him by nationwide voter fraud, other prominent figures within the Republican ranks, including two of Trump's former national security advisors, were very blunt. Former Trump national security advisor John Bolton said Biden would be sworn in January. Bolton added, "The real question is how much damage Donald Trump can do before that happens." The president's efforts were designed mainly to sow chaos and confusion, John Bolton told CNN's State of the Union show, as a demonstration more of raw political power than a genuine legal exercise. John Bolton noted that the Trump campaign has so far lost all but two of more than 30 legal challenges in various states. Right now, Donald Trump is throwing rocks through windows. He's the political equivalent of a street rioter, Bolton said. Another former Trump administration national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, told CBS's Face the Nation that Trump's efforts were very corrosive and warned that his actions were sowing doubt among the electorate. "It's playing into the hands of our adversaries," H.R. McMaster said, warning that Russia, for example, doesn't care who wins the election as long as many Americans doubt the result, undermining America's democracy. On Sunday evening, hours after former New Jersey governor and advisor to the president Chris Christie said Trump's legal team was a national embarrassment, the campaign issued a statement distancing itself from lawyer Sidney Powell, who has been a prominent figure arguing the Trump case that the election was fraudulent, whilst positing wild theories, but with no evidence. Meanwhile, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, another Republican, said he also was confident that Joe Biden will be sworn in on schedule on 20th of January. Larry Hogan said, "I'm embarrassed at the lack of party leadership speaking out to recognize the election result." Larry Hogan added that he thought Trump's pressuring last week of state legislators to somehow try to change the outcome of the election was completely outrageous. The U.S. used to supervise elections around the world, but was now beginning to look like we're a banana republic, Larry Hogan told CNN's State of the Union politics show. Hogan later tweeted in response to a critical tweet from Donald Trump, who had gone to the golf course for the second time in this weekend. Hogan tweeted, "Stop golfing and concede." Larry Hogan's full tweet reads, "If you had done your job, America's governors wouldn't have been forced to fend for themselves to find tests in the middle of a pandemic, as we successfully did in Maryland. Stop golfing and concede."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Islamadi, Islamadi, Allah my Lord, His word Quran, His word Quran, Muhammad Prophet, Muhammad Prophet, praise be upon, praise be upon, I am Muslim for all of time.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Assalamu alaikum, welcome to Youth Station everyone. You're here with us at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Mehdi, and with myself I have my friend and co-host here, Hamza Hussaini.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam, Hamza, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Before we start, I'll just try to explain what we do here. We've got different topics that people might have in their minds, questions, and we are trying to have a general conversation about it over here. So today, the first thing we're going to be speaking about is what are the elite? As you know, everyone in their gatherings in society, they've got different people who are known as elite in that society. So what really defines elite, the word elite?
So elite, in my opinion, well, what is known around worldwide at the moment, elite are like the people who are at the top of the range kind of thing, you know? Like, for example, if you look in the West or anywhere else around the world, elite are either known as the people who have the highest of qualities within education, or they have the highest status, like financially, like presidents, people of the government, or people who have the most knowledge. We can put it into that context as well. Like, for example, if we want to put it into financial situations, like the elite are the most rich. But whereas if we put it into the educational, like, point of view,
the more learned you are,
the more learned you are. Or, like, for example, we can put it this way as well, like the most elite scholars, right? Mm-hmm. That we have nowadays, like the Maharajas, the Ayatollahs, and the high-end scholars that are in that. But what mostly comes to people's minds is the elite forces or the elite system, which is in any kind of society, like the rich people or that kind of thing. Whoever has the highest capacity or the highest quality in any kind of thing, you call them, like, if you want to go according to the verbal dictionary or whatever, you can say that the people who have the most of something in any subject.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Like, Da Vinci is the elite of art. So in terms of art, Da Vinci and Picasso, I think, you know, people like those, they're the elite, and we still have museums that host their paintings and stuff like that. They're valuable. In terms of science, you know, Einstein? Well, you know why I'm talking about these people, because I want to bring it back to our elites. Mm-hmm. For example,
scholars, right?
Yeah, yeah. But like, in terms of all these fields, for example, art or science, like
arts
in art
of Islamic science, so.
Arts and Islam, yeah, yeah. Like, for example, art.
There's a lot of artists that are well known in Iran. I don't know. I did see a video which went viral on Instagram and YouTube recently. It was of this girl. I think she was from Tehran or something. She was disabled, but she would write with her and draw paintings with her feet. It was amazing. Unfortunately, I forgot the name.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
So we do have artists in the Islamic world as well, but they don't get, like, publicized as much as, you know, Picasso and these guys.
True. I'm trying to focus about the old school people, for example, Avicenna and all those people. You know, Avicenna was a boss at medicine. You know, he's the elite. Like, we have our elite in medicine is
Ibn Sina.
Yeah, Ibn Sina or Avicenna. Mostly in the West, that's how they know him. For example, with Sheikh Bahai.
Sheikh Bahai.
You know, we've got like a prodigies like these people. Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari. He's known in the Western world also.
Yeah, yeah, that's
you
right.
You know, like, are these our elites or are they generally all of the world?
When we say elite, either we want to take the verbal sense of it, which is taken from the dictionary, right? Or either there's elite, which is well known in society, like such as these high rank religious authorities and stuff. And they're well known of like the elite of our Muslim or Shia societies, right?
So, you know, I like the fact that you distributed these two things, the most widely known people who are elites, right? Yeah. But then you said there's another thing that's a formal definition. That's more, you know, if it's all right to put it this way, civilized, you know?
Yeah.
There's a specific ranking and all that. Not just a general opinion. For example, right now we think whoever owns the most wealth is the elite in the world, you know? For example, like, not very appropriate to take the name. I don't like to take these names, but, you know, still Rothschild, for example.
Yeah.
You know, these people are known as the elites of our world.
There's also that group, isn't it, that say controls most of the wealth of the world as well?
They actually run the game right now, you know? All these lobbyings and stuff like that. These people own the power. Is it all right to, you know, be submissive to these people And is it all right to be submissive to those other elites that we talked about, the civilized elites, for example, you know? As you mentioned, they're like some religious scholars, authorities, right? Are you not supposed to be submissive to what they have to put forward and tell you in terms of knowledge, right? Well, we learn from them. That's different. Like, that submission is a bit different to this submission, isn't it?
I think it's 180 degrees in the opposite direction. If we want to follow some kind of elite power, which we look at, like, for example, these rich families, I'm saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have nothing to do with Islamic values or human values at all. They just have, like, power, which they have that moderate power over people, which is just, like, for showing off, basically, you can say, right? Or trying to get their way. Whereas if you look at, on the other factor, like the Islamic elites, as the verbal, like, formal description, as I would say again. Yeah, so we don't get both of them mixed up. So these ones are actually, or these elites of such as the Marajas or the Ayatollahs, right? They're showing us the right path. They're showing us how to live a life, right? How not to live under oppression and stuff like that. Whereas the other ones, they just want to control us by their power. So that's the difference between both of them. Whereas one, we're getting our Islamic values shown, how to live a perfect life, how to live within society. The elite, we were saying that we have the Maraja within our society, right? But they are not well known to the outer world. Probably just a few people within the Islamic society, or even probably a few Islamic students or the ones that come to study over here. And then the rest of the people probably just hear their names here and there, but they don't actually hear their qualities and how the other elites are well known within society.
Even in these scholars that you talked about, besides the fact that they were, in terms of religion, masterminds, you know, like in terms of they had the knowledge that they used to produce, you know, besides those people also that we'll come back to, we mentioned Sheikh Bahai right now, you know. It's mind-blowing that he'd been able to crack the codes of, I don't know, how the gas under the bathroom, you know, old school bathrooms. There was steam rooms, and they used to go for bathing over there. It was lit by one candle. Do you know that?
Wow. Yeah, I did actually go and see a few museums, but it was amazing, like the science that these guys used and how much it obviously took some kind of research.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like how you compare it, like, oh, one of the Western scientists who apple fell on his head and he was, wow, that was gravity, man. You had to actually, like, sit down and do some research for that.
Yeah.
But these guys aren't well known in the outer world.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone who come after them and they'll copy the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they'll become well known.
Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari, have you ever heard of whom he learned from? We'll be surprised.
You'll have to enlighten us.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, our sixth imam. Isn't that mind blowing? He's so famous, but where his roots are, that's not well known. Why? Propaganda. I don't know. Uh-huh. Is that so?
He's well known within the Islamic societies, right? But if you go and look into the West, it's not that well known.
Yeah, you're right. But like, even in Islamic societies, man. Because, right, we live as Muslim nations, right, in different worlds. But our media is still, like, almost one-sided. So myself, it's been a few years that I found out that there was a person like that, rather than being, you know, a toddler or a child, that we hear about all these elites. For example, Einstein. Everyone says Einstein. Children say Einstein, right?
Yeah.
But they hear that. They don't even know him.
How the media portrays it, actually, how the system works, and how everyone wants to learn everything from the West, whereas if they look in reality...
Which is the most famous library that you know about?
It's in London.
Or Oxford, for example.
Oxford Library, yeah.
What's special about those libraries?
And then there's Central London Library as well, yeah.
Yeah, what's
it's
so special
massive.
About it? That's it. It's massive.
Yeah.
Like, I could just build a large place and fill it up with random books and, you know, get to know it.
The library of Agha Marashi Najafi is going to say that, wasn't he? Look at all the struggles that Ayatollah Marashi has been through just to build up this library in Qom, and no one in the world, like, hardly knows about it.
Yeah, you're right. Being a Muslim, I'd never heard about it until I was here myself.
Yeah, you know, same here as
I had no idea. Just For a brief, I want to know, you know, it's very interesting to go and look at how this library was built and what kind of books there are in there. This person that we're talking about, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, he wasn't financially very well, and he had this passion for books and knowledge that he went out of his way to just gather all these books, which have, you know, become...
Like him and his wife used to keep fasts, and like they call them,
for example, some people have passed away and they haven't been able to fast in their life. So there's this system that people provide the opportunity for someone else to be able to keep those fasts, and they pay them not a very considerable amount for that thing.
They used to do that, and then Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, and this is how I heard the story, that he was going out and he was going to buy some stuff, apparently. And he had seen one Englishman, and he had came to buy, like, some really old, old books, right? Mm-hmm. Islamic books. So this guy was there in the bookstore. Well, I think they used to just have them, like, on the sides at that time, right?
They still do.
Yeah. At like, in the side of the alleys, right?
Yeah, they still
like,
do.
That's how... And he was collecting them all. So Ayatollah Marashi Najafi asks the guy who's selling the books and stuff, he's like, why is this guy buying all these books? Where does he want to take them? So apparently he found out that this guy, he wants to take all these books and go and put them into the Western libraries as antiques. So then after that, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi came to this conclusion. He said that if they take all of our knowledge, like 100 or 200 years down the line, we'll have nothing left. Because it's all our hard work, right? We're going through all these struggles, our scholars, they've given lives for this knowledge. So what he done was, he came up with this excellent plan, and with all these fasts and stuff, like as you explained, and after that, him and his wife, they went through all this hardship just to make this this library, which is near the shrine of Hazrat Masumah. 90% of the people who come here.
Ancient scriptures, handwritten. Firstly, they're antiques. Secondly, they're handwritten, all of them. Well, not all of the ones, all of them in the library, but like their books, which are like those. And imagine people, if they knew about this, for example, when you go to a country and certain countries are famous for certain things, yeah? You go to a country and you hear about this library that it's got all this stuff that this library has over here, you'd actually... visit that city just to visit that library. But like, we have people who live here or who visit this place but have no idea that there's a place like this that
they could visit. That's exactly how it is.
For example, like I'd like to mention Ayatollah Jawadi Amali. For example, these people are elites, you know. It's been 30 years that they've been lecturing on one book, which is the Quran, right? When you look at a science, you never say that, wait a second, this theory or this law wasn't there 100 years ago, so how has this person come up with this law, right? You constantly wait for these people to come out with a conclusion and provide us with, you know, something new, right? But when it comes to religion, we don't have that enthusiasm or, you know, that inquisitiveness that we can go around and find out if there's new knowledge being spread about for us, you know. 30 years, and he's been lecturing on the Quran. Apparently, it's a small book. But, like, 30 years, and they've been still on about exegesis of the Holy Quran. These people are elite that we actually encourage people who are listening to us to actually go out and find out about these people. For example, like Allama Hilli, it's mind-blowing that at the age of 9 he was knowledgeably one of the high authorities of jurisprudence of Islam at the age of 9. And the only reason he was not officially accepted was because there's a rule that you have to be you have to reach puberty before you are considered as an authority, and that was the only reason he was not an authority at the age of 9. Imagine that. What kind of elite do we have that we're not aware of, you know?
We don't have the enthusiasm, right, for these elites. I think that the enthusiasm comes alongside with something like when it's famous, right, or well known in society, it becomes a trend and a mode, right, what they say. So for example, when a child is really small, right? They look at someone really famous, soon, like, for example, when small, like David Beckham or something like that.
Yeah.
And because why? He was well known in society and he was really famous. Now, exactly like that, we're lacking a little bit of something here as well. For example, getting the names and the attributes and the speeches and the knowledge of our Ayatollahs or our Islamic Marajas and stuff out to society.
It's our job right now to actually go out first and look at whom we have, and after we find out for ourselves, we actually promote those people and let people know about them. Thank you for being here, Hamza. I hope that you do join us.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, until next time, everyone that has been with us, take care. And from myself and Hamza over here,
goodbye from me too.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. That everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
Food for thought.
Hello dear listeners, and congratulations to you all on the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him, the 11th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Let us listen to one of his beautiful advices. Luck has degrees. So do not hasten towards a fruit that it is not ripe yet, because it is picked only at its time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Today's special. Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Salaam alaikum and welcome to this program, today's special. On a special occasion, that is birthday anniversary of Imam Hassan al-Askari, peace be upon him. Dear friend, accept our congratulations on this auspicious aid.
Every sound and every voice in every language ever heard. Each drop of ink that has been used to write every single word. They could never portray everything I feel in my heart and wanna say. And it's hard to explain why I could never describe my love for you.
Today, Tuesday, is the 8th of Rabiul Thani, 1442 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 4th of Azar, 1399 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 24th of November, 2020 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Again, we express our congratulations on the birthday anniversary of Shia's 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam.
يا من أتيت فزدت حبنا أسعدتنا وجمعت شملنا أنت هدية من الله لنا بعد انتظارنا لك طول السنة فيك السرور والهنا حمدا لك يا ربنا Let's enjoy this happy day. Eid Mubarak, come on, let's celebrate.
Rain, water, and guidance. It happened that during Imam al-Askari's imamate of 6 years, drought and dry spell afflicted most of Iraq and Syria. This situation was exploited by a Christian hermit who stepped forward with promise of rain, and he did succeed in bringing down a shower or two whenever he lifted his hands towards the sky. The people were amazed. The self-styled caliph had no choice but to return to venerable descendant of the prophet to save the state. The 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari, asked the Christian priest to first remove a certain object that he was holding between his fingers and then pray for rain. Now when the hermit did so, no cloud appeared and no rain fell. Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam explained that the hermit had somehow acquired a bone of one of the prophets of the past, and whenever he exposed it to the heavens, divine mercy made some showers. The Imam then smiled, and after performing a special two-rak'ah prayer, he prostrated to Allah. He then raised his hands towards the heavens and humbly entreated Allah to send ample rainfall. Suddenly, dense clouds appeared and heavy rains fell, giving new life to the land and the people. Congratulate on the auspicious birthday anniversary of Imam Hassan al-Askari, peace be upon him. Dr. Fakhr Rouhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa bi nasta'in. Regarding the life and times of the 11th infallible Imam, Al-Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam, it must be indicated that in addition to being the father of the last and final infallible Imam, Al-Mahdi Salamullah alayhi and Ajalla Ta'ala Faraju Sharif, Imam Al-Hassan Al-Askari alayhi salam, was very much active in educating many of his close companions. According to the great Shiite scholar Sheikh Tusi, such personalities like Ahmad ibn Ishaq Ash'ari Qumi, Abu Hashim, Dawood ibn Qasim Ja'fari, Abu Amr, Usman ibn Sa'id Amri, Ali ibn Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Safar, and many other people, the list of which amount to at least 100 dignitaries and important people, were all educated in the school of Imam al-Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. And it must be indicated that, for example, Ahmad ibn Ishaq al-Ash'ari al-Qumi, who was one of the representatives and delegates of Imam al-Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam in Qum, was among the personalities who had the honor of meeting up with Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam when Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam was still a child. Another one is that although Imam al-Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam was living in Samarra and in a military camp, in a military garrison, he had close contact with his representatives and his delegates in a number of cities in the whole Muslim lands, like, for example, in Kufa, Baghdad, Nishabur, Qum, Abe, Madain, Khorasan, Yemen, Ray, Azerbaijan, Samarra, Jorjan, Basra, and other people. And Imam al-Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, by means of this network and a systematic network of representatives, Imam al-Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam used to receive the updates about those places and communities. And by the same token, Imam al-Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam answered the queries and led them to the best answer. Thank you.
Said Al-Abid, full of compassion. Kindness in our hearts, when all the fun starts, exhilaration. Smiles everywhere, delight in the air, jollification. Oh, trips, endless full visits, colorful outfits, mark this occasion.
Samarra, located around 100 kilometers north of Baghdad, was a garrison town, often called military encampment, since the word askar in Arabic is used for the army. Some believe the 11th Imam title, Al-Askari, was derived from this. However, there is an interesting account related by many historians. It is said that once the caliph called the 11th Imam to his palace and ordered his army to stage a march past before him. The Abbasid ruler wanted to impress the Imam of his power. When the march past was over, the Imam was asked his opinion in this regard by crafty caliph. He smiled and lifting his two fingers, told the Abbasid ruler to gaze between them. What the caliph saw was a huge army of angels extending towards the sky. Caliph was astonished at this miracle and called the 11th Imam Al-Askari, that is the person with the huge army, at his beck and call. Dear friend, again, we congratulate this auspicious day, birthday anniversary of Imam Hassan Al-Askari. Peace be upon him.
Families are gathering, remembering Allah, and that His love is the greatest by far. All praise for you, Allah, all thanks to you. The joy of Eid comes only from you.
Glad tidings. One day, Imam Hassan al-Askari spoke to his close companion with these words. Indeed, God has never left the earth empty of a proof upon his creation, since he created Adam, and will not leave it empty of the proof until the hour of reckoning emerges. Through him, the proof, God pushes calamity away from the people of earth through him. He brings down the rain, and through him, he extracts the blessings of the earth. The companion asked, O son of God's messenger, who then is the imam and successor after you? The 11th imam rose to his feet quickly and went inside his home. Soon enough, imam came back with a 3-year-old boy in his arms. Imam al-Askari turned to his companion and said, If it were not for your honor before Allah and the proofs of Allah, the imams, I would not have shown you this son of mine. Indeed, his name is that of God's messenger, as in his title, he is the one who will fill the earth with fairness and justice, just as it has been filled with tyranny and injustice. By God, he will disappear from physical sight, such as occultation, that no one will be saved from peril in it except those whom God has fortified on reasoning and faith in saying that he is the imam, and whom Allah has helped succeed in praying for hastening his advent. Amen.
Historians tell us that either the 8th or the 10th day of Rabi'ul Akhir or Rabi'ul Thani is the day which marks the birth of the 11th Imam of the school of Ahlul Bayt, Al-Imam Al-Hasan Al-Askari alayhi salam, who was born in the year 232 after Hijrah. And historians tell us that the Imam, just like his father and just like many of his forefathers, lived in a very repressive and a very difficult time during the time of the Abbasis, who especially towards the Imams of Ahlul Bayt and the families of Ahlul Bayt, who were very oppressive and repressive. Although in some instances publicly they would show support, publicly they would honor, but in fact privately and in reality they expressed a lot of hatred and animosity towards the Imams of Ahlul Bayt. And so historians tell us that the Imam, he grew up in a very difficult time in Samarra, Surra Man Ra'a. And the Imam, in fact, lived for a very short period of time. Historians tell us that the Imam lived for 28 years. That he was 28 years old when he achieved martyrdom, when he left this life. And this, brothers and sisters, and I've said this before, when we come across certain occasions when we celebrate the birth of a family, an imam of Ahlul Bayt, or very important person in history, or we commemorate their martyrdom or their death, it's a time for us to reflect. It's a time for us to think about how this personality lived his or her life, how they conducted themselves. And so for me especially, I ask myself about this great imam who achieved such a great heritage, intellectual heritage and ethical heritage and legacy, an imam who died at the age of 28 years old, had accomplished this and so much more. And so I have to ask myself, as a follower of this imam, what am I doing to relate to this imam?
Dear friend, that was today's special. And again, we congratulate on birthday anniversary of Shia's 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Till another program of today's special, may Allah keep you all safe. Fi amanillah.
This is the day of greed. This is the day of greed.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.